I'm Faith Middleton. You can tweet us at FaithWNPR or join the conversation with us on Facebook. Search The Faith Middleton Show. Thanks to you for listening and to our talented team, senior producer Lori Mack and producer Jonathan McNichol. I was just thinking, sitting here listening to that conversation with Peter Matheson, wouldn't it be something if we had an interview with every person who dies? Can you imagine what that would be like for the people still living around that person? And as a kind of tribute of just making it through this life, wouldn't that be something? Okay, developing confidence, strengthening relationships, resolving conflict, people tools. That's what Alan Fox calls them, and it's the name of his book. Fox has degrees in accounting, law, education, and writing. He's a very successful real estate entrepreneur, writer, and philanthropist. His book, People Tools in Paperback, is filled with his own version of wisdom. And when I saw that three leaders of American Zen Buddhism had all written endorsements on the back of the book, I became curious. That would be Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and Sharon Salzberg. Mr. Fox, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Faith.
Solve the mystery for me, if you would. How did these three, in particular, the leaders of American Buddhism, end up endorsing a book that doesn't really brand itself as Buddhist?
Well, that's a very good question. I met all three of them about 25 or 30 years ago, at the time when Jack Kornfield was first establishing Spirit Rock in Marin County. And, I followed them for years, grew to be good friends. I also edited and published Rattle, a poetry magazine, which has been out for about 18 years. And one of my best interviews of all time was with Jack Kornfield. So I'm very much into the idea of mindfulness. I think the book, even though it's not a Buddhist book, does incorporate many Buddhist principles.
And what does that mean to you when you use that word mindfulness? We just kind of toss that around these days. What does that mean to you?
Absolutely. To me, I think it's encapsulated in the next to last people tool in the book, and that is being mindful every moment of what you're doing. If you're walking, being mindful of the act of walking, your breath, of course, the fragrances in the air. If you're working, focusing on your work and paying attention to that. I think it's just paying attention to who you are, where you are, and what's going on as much as you possibly can.
You name these people tools, using, I think, what you would describe as a kind of clever thing so that people will remember. And so there, you have a rule that has to do with a belt buckle. And this really is about, you say, judging people and their actions. So what's that tool about?
Well, Faith, that's the first tool I wrote, actually. I was reading an interview with an All-American defensive college football player, and he was asked, how do you tackle the great runners? And he said, well, you know, the great runners can fake with their eyes, they can fake with their head, they can fake with their shoulders, they can't fake with their belt buckle. Wherever their belt buckle is going, that's where they're going. I just watch the belt buckle. And so, again, I think in terms of mindfulness, I watch what people do, and I watch what I do. And my point here is that if there's a difference between what someone does and what they say, go with what they do. Go with the belt buckle.
Go with what they do. So it's that old saying, actions speak louder than words.
Absolutely right. That's correct.
Of course, arguments develop at home and in workplaces. And you have this idea about, instead of conversation, what you call nonversation as a way to resolve arguments quickly and effectively. How does nonversation work?
Okay. And again, this is paying attention. I think when we're having a conversation, part of what we do is think about what we're going to say next, what we can offer, what we want to get out. Especially in a conflict situation with my wife, for example, if she has something she, you know, wants me to change or complain of some kind, we have a nonversation. In other words, it's her turn, she talks, she tells me what's going on, and all I do is listen, and make sure that I understand exactly what she's saying. And again, that's by mindfully paying attention. And the good part is she feels heard. And in fact, I do hear her, and I don't have to make up excuses. I don't have to say you're wrong or you do it more than I do or whatever. So a non-versation gets the message. And then if we want to talk about it further at another time, we can do that. But a non-versation at that time, one person talks and the other person pays strict attention.
Well, that's a very interesting area right there. I think what often happens for people, it certainly has happened to me, is someone will say something and it inflames you and you're off and running. And so I wonder how you do this. You hear someone saying something that might be sensitive for you or you might think that's inaccurate. How do you avoid being defensive, coming back with, no, this is the really the way that it happened? How do you do that?
All right. Well, it's a wonderful question. And, you know, I'm working right now on People Tools for Business, which will be out in October, and I was writing that chapter yesterday. Here's the deal. I have two ideas. First, I wait 3 days. You know, like everybody else, I've had really bad news from time to time, a letter, a notice of internal revenue, a lawsuit, and it's very upsetting. I don't respond for 3 days. And by the end of 3 days, it kind of is blended into the background of everything else in my life, and I don't have to get upset. And the other idea is this. When someone is angry and is full of invective and anger and loud talk, I don't have to respond to that. I can respond to the content of what's going on. And Let me tell you a quick story, Faith. I was on a radio interview recently, and the host was a therapist, and she told me that she was in Baskin-Robbins with her son, and the 17-year-old man behind the counter was really treating people rudely. When she paid, he took her credit card and he frisbeed it across the room, and she had to go retrieve it under a table. And she came back, and instead of being angry at him, she said, "You know, you're really having a hard day." And he said, "Yes. My wrist, I sprained my wrist badly. It hurts to scoop the ice cream. I asked my boss for the night off, and he said no, so I have to work." And then the therapist said, "Well, that must even hurt worse to not be heard." And you know, he melted. He burst into tears, and he gave everybody really good service. So you see, when someone is angry and treating you badly, you don't have to respond. You know, I mean, I live by the idea that what happens to us is not within our control. Our actions in response are within our control.
There is a thing that the people in business say about being careful about turning clients into friends, and that this can be a kind of dangerous business. And you write in your book, People Tools, about the personal and the professional, and how that's based largely on developing great relationships with people.
Yes.
So what is the difference there?
The difference is this. I think that you have to be able to compartmentalize. So in other words, if I'm with a person who is an investor of mine, I'm talking business, and I'm fulfilling my role as consultant, answering his questions, and that kind of thing. If we're friends, also, we go out to lunch, maybe we're not going to talk about business anymore. We're going to talk about our families, our dreams, what's going on in our lives. So I think that we all do compartmentalize. And, you know, very often I found that, for example, I had a date to go out with another couple Friday night, and Friday night comes, and, you know, I'm tired, I'm grumpy, I don't want to do it. But I honor my commitments, we go out to dinner. I always, every time, feel better later. So you can have different relationships with the same person. And I actually think we all do that at times. With your spouse, you serve different roles.
This is Alan Fox. His book is in paperback, and it's called People Tools. And he is talking in this book about what has served him well. He's had multiple careers as a philanthropist, a business person, is into mindfulness. What I hear you describing right there is an ability to speak many languages. So in the old days, this isn't true anymore, young people knew enough and were skilled enough to have a language they used with their friends, which could be filled with obscenities. But you, when you were around someone older, someone you were taught to respect, you wouldn't dream of using that language in public or around your family members. You know, on the bus these days or on the train or on the street, that doesn't happen so much anymore. People just say whatever they want. But it taught me a lot about our sort of innate ability to speak languages.
And I think that's absolutely right. And if you're a parent and you have a child, at one time you may be comforting your child. Other times you may be explaining. Other times you may raise your voice because they're in danger and you don't want them to run across the street and be hit by a car. And I agree. That's something that we have to learn. And maybe it's not so much today as it used to be.
There's a tool you talk about, sunk cost, and this is how to assess whether a situation is worth pursuing or dropping. And this can be in your personal life or in your business life. So I want to talk with you about that. We're going to take a quick break, Alan, and then I hope you'll stay where you are so we can continue. We're going to open the phones at 203-776-9677. Have conversation with Alan Fox, and we'll be right back. You can find what we talk about on the show online anytime at WNPR.org. Right now, you can see all kinds of delicious recipes for dinner, value wines, and so much more. Click on programs at WNPR.org for the Faith Middleton Show. And you will find information about my guest, Alan Fox, who's done this book, People Tools. So, Alan, this you describe as sunk cost, a way to figure out if a situation's worth pursuing or dropping. And that's always the key in business. And when you think about it in your personal life too. So how do we as people distance ourselves from what you'd call sunk cost?
Well, that's exactly the right question. Sunk cost means that in business school, we learn if you purchase a machine and pay $1 million and you just started using it last week, we all have an investment, and we've paid $1 million, and we have an emotional investment in making that work. But if someone comes along with a new machine, which will make twice as many of your product at half the cost, it's probably a better idea to forget about the old machine and buy the new one. Now, in life, for example, if my wife and I buy tickets to a concert, and then we drive there and park and go to the airport, and we're sitting there, and we don't like it, now the fact that we've already paid for it and paid with our life and time to be there is not relevant. What we have to do is look at this moment forward and not look back. And if we're looking forward and I've spent 45 minutes at a concert that I don't like, why should I spend another hour? And, you know, I'm just going to leave, realizing that the cost is in the past. There's nothing I can do about that. What I can do is have my future the best possible.
So you're making me think about the stock market. We are all, as human beings, famous for this, and lots of economists and academics study this area. We buy something in stocks or mutual funds, if we're lucky enough to be able to do it, and hang on to them, instead of doing what you're describing. Realize that you've bought something that's not working, and get out of it.
Yes, I think that's right, Faith. And the stock market is one of my Achilles heels. I never do well. I bought a stock recently when it dropped a lot, thought it would go up. It didn't. And you know something? When it got back to almost where I bought it, I sold it at a small loss. And then, of course, it went up further. But you're right. It's sunk cost, which is in the past, is exactly in the past.
Well, this gets at what you talk about a lot in the book, patterns. That we all have them if we watch ourselves, and usually the people around us have them too. And the idea is to figure out what those patterns are within yourself and for somebody else.
That's precisely. You know, on patterns, I have a saying in my family, and we talk about it often, that patterns persist. And, for example, if I go to a buffet restaurant, I'm going to eat a lot. That's my pattern, 99 times out of 100. Now, I can engage in wishful thinking and say, well, now this time I'm going to do it differently. And yet, I don't. And so with myself and with other people, if they have a pattern, if someone is always 15 minutes late, then if I assume they'll be 15 minutes late, I'll almost always be right. And it's important to identify the patterns you like and continue those, and identify the patterns you don't like in yourself and others and try to do something about changing it. But don't do wishful thinking that this pattern will just go away, because more than often it will not.
This idea of apologizing, you said there has, you've rarely seen a situation in your work or personal life where an apology was not useful.
That's true. I had a situation, I've been in business with one of my partners for more than 25 years, and about a month ago, I was on the phone with him and another person, and I was, frankly, rather nasty to my partner 25 years, and he didn't call me for 3 days. Then he called and said, Alan, you humiliated me in front of somebody else, and I'm very, very upset. Now, you know, most of us would think, well, I didn't do anything wrong. Well, whether you did anything right or wrong is not relevant, and you don't have to admit you did something wrong. I said, it was certainly not my intent to humiliate you. I just don't do that, and I'm very sorry that that's the way it turned out. And he felt a lot better, and we go forward, and we've had no problems since. Now, you know, if I refuse to apologize, it's only for him feeling humiliated. I'm sorry it turned out that way, and I am. And, you know, I think you have to be honest. I don't think you can apologize if you can't do it sincerely. But find something you can apologize for, and your relationship will be a lot better.
So you don't think that's one of those non-apology apologies where, you know, where you...
to me, a non-apology apology is when you're not sincere. You know, if I said, yeah, okay, I'm sorry I did that. Well, that doesn't sound too sincere. And you know, but finding yourself, you see, I am sorry I did it. I am sorry I did it because I didn't want him to be upset. I want to have good relationships with people I work with. So the non-apology apology is mostly when it's really phony.
It reminds me of that. I'm trying to think which president it was who said after something bad, mistakes were made. And I remember just slapping my thigh thinking, well, that's a brilliant little statement.
There's been a lot of stuff about Don Rumsfeld recently. It could have been him. He is always certain that he's right. And a documentary just came out on that. And you're right. You know, your reaction is the way we would react to that.
So you have about 54 of these people tools that you discuss in the book. And you say that the most important thing out of all of them would be to know yourself. And by that you mean what?
Well, I think that in order to know who you are and to get the most out of your life, you have to know yourself. And by that I mean know what you like, what you don't like, what you can do, what you can't do. Many people get stuck in a job that they just hate. And know yourself. Know what you want to do and not. I'm very good with numbers. I enjoy numbers. Many people don't. I don't enjoy retail and being behind a counter and meeting strangers all day long. And I'm not real good at it. Now, if you know what you're good at and what you like and you do that, then you're really going to be a lot better off and way ahead of the game in terms of enjoying your life. You know, the first sentence in my book is, if you have joy in your life, what else do you really need? And that's also the last sentence in the book. So this is all in service, knowing yourself, is finding joy in your life and finding what you enjoy and also conversely what you don't enjoy.
As we have the New Haven psychologist, Dr. Nancy Horn, on the show quite regularly, and she talks about a piece of what you're discussing, that often people don't know what gives them energy. They don't think of themselves as creative people. And they don't really know the conditions for thriving, and that is, I guess that would be a block for joy. So I'm trying to get at how many people out there don't know what gives them joy, beyond a few obvious things.
I think that's probably true. There was a recent article in the New York Times on creative people and what they do, daydreaming and things like that. And you know, I think you can get a lot of information. In fact, I wrote a blog on that at PeopleToolsBook.com on creativity. And sometimes it's not clear what you really enjoy because you have a pattern of not knowing. And if you can identify that pattern, then ask your friends, ask other people, what do you see me enjoying? And you know, sometimes your friends and family will know you in certain respects better than you know yourself.
We've stayed kind of clear of personal relationships. I know you've been married for a long time. You have lots of kids, and you appear to have done this quite successfully. So I'm wondering, do you have a formula that you think has worked for you in your personal relationships? I mean, within the family, let's say.
Oh, absolutely. The formula that works for me with my kids is catch them being good. And that's the title of the book I read years ago. When people, especially your kids, do something you like, just praise the heck out of them. Because we all... There was years ago, it was transactional analysis, which said we all want recognition. What we prefer is positive recognition, but we'll take negative recognition, you know, don't do that, which is we want that more than we don't want to be ignored. So I don't ignore my children. My bias when they want something is to say yes, and when they do something I like, I catch them being good. And I do that for everybody I know. I do it for myself. If I do something that turns out well and I like, I say, Alan, that was great. You know, maybe you want to do that again.
And do you see this working on them? I mean, have you used that technique when you've seen a young person struggling, seriously struggling with something, or you know, has disappointed you in a very serious way?
Well, that's okay. I'm there to offer support. If I am disappointed in a serious way, chances are the young person is disappointed too. And I'm not going to be judgmental. I'm not going to say you're a bad person, this is forever, you'll never make it. I mean, I've heard parents in the grocery store saying to their kids, you're stupid, you'll never make it. And those messages, I'm going to write a book on people tools for raising children about 2 years from now. But if you allow those negative thoughts to take over, you're going to believe them. And I think, especially for kids and young people, they've got to be given support and understanding that someone understands. You know, I might share mistakes I made, so that they don't feel all alone in their misery about having made a mistake.
What about failure at work? It is such a competitive atmosphere out there right now, and I hear from all kinds of people in New York that they're afraid to take chances that might lead to really great things, because if they make a mistake, failure's not valued, you get labeled, and therefore a lot of opportunities missed.
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. And actually, as I think I mentioned, I'm writing a book on people tools for business. But, you know, look, I saw an interview on 60 Minutes with Elon Musk, who founded SpaceX, PayPal, and most recently Tesla. And he was asked about Tesla. He said, you know, did you think it would succeed? He said, no. He said, I didn't think it would succeed. I thought the odds were against. I did it because it's something that should be done. It's better for the environment, et cetera. And I think anyone who has succeeded big time, Steve Jobs, you know, before he died, Apple was the most valuable corporation in the entire world. And yet, in 1985, Steve Jobs was fired from the company he founded. And that's a pretty darn big failure. And 10 years later, he was back, and then he built it into something fantastic. So I think you have to understand that failure precedes success. And as a scientist will tell you, if an experiment fails, then they can eliminate one hypothesis. So they've really succeeded in eliminating one possibility and then go on and test many more.
Alan,
so I think, go ahead.
I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on the show. I'm so sorry we're out of time. You've been a pal, and I thank you so much. Author of People Tools. As always, this show is about the richness of life, and you can find the books, people, great recipes, value wines that we feature right now at WNPR.org. Click on Programs in New Haven. I'm Faith Middleton.